Hey, sorry, I forgot to start the recording, Jack. Thank you. Certainly, we are in the first part of April, looking like much better weather, and we're looking forward to summer. Let's get right into it because we have a guest on the call. I don't want to keep him for very long. So let's just talk about the stock market very quickly, and then I'll sort of talk about our monthly, which is coming out right after the call, and our guest, who's the head of the team that authored our research report, which I think everybody will find very interesting. So with the S&P, the spiders, the long-term trend system is up. We are trading in this whole resistance area. Certainly the market has been nice and strong in terms of the S&P, not so much in terms of small cap and transports. Those two trend systems are down. We are still in a major trend system, Desmond, as I call it, with transports, and the small cap index is down, and the S&P and the NASDAQ composite up. We would just mention this is how we were in the summer of 2015. We don't think this is a big, oh, my God, we have to sell stocks, but we are a little bit more cautious here. A pullback would be very welcome to reload the daily indicators, and we think that's possible. We've had some questions about adding cash. We think that all new accounts that come in should be getting into models, but we are carrying or recommending, especially for cautious advisors, to carry a bit more cash to buy a dip, depending on how that looks. And we want to be very clear, there's a difference between new money and new accounts here in our view. New accounts, you have to start getting them into your models. New money, you don't necessarily have to rush in. Okay, we're going to skip a little bit ahead and talk about something that we don't normally talk about. One of the things about ETFs that has been very interesting to me is the lack of transparency or lack of thought about the indexing process. I'll give an example of that. When I'm out in the field with some of the Invesco wholesalers, I will mention, we've got SPLV trading history that goes back to 2011, 2012, but the index provider has actually run this back all the way to 1990, and you can get the data and look at it. That made me think about, golly, where are these indexes coming from? How are these indexes tested? And all that sort of thing. So what we were able to do at Inside ETS, we were very, very fortunate to meet a gentleman named Patrick Shadow, who was on the call, we think. He is the head of an index providing team. So what he has done for us in the monthly, and I realize you guys haven't read the monthly yet because the funeral I had to go to and a couple of other things were just publishing a little later. But since Patrick is an index developer and an index provider, his team was kind enough to write an article on PCEF, one of the ETFs we're using in our income model, how that came about, how they built the index, how they tested it. So I'm going to sort of put Patrick on the call here for a second and on the spot. If anyone, before reading this article, has any questions for Patrick about how an index comes about or how it's provided, I'm going to ask Patrick to just say a few words about that, and then, of course, we'll take any questions. And obviously, if anyone has questions after they read the article, we'll have Patrick back on the call at a later date and answer those questions. So, Patrick, if you have anything for us, star 6 to unmute your phone.
Yeah, thank you. And I have, Fred, and just by way of introduction, my name is Patrick Shadow, and I work for a small niche index providing company called S Network Global Indexes. Our company was recently nominated as Index Provider of the Year by ETF.com, and we have about 13 U.S. listed ETFs and 7 conventional 40 Act mutual funds and 3 different UITs and a slew of separately managed accounts that follow our intellectual property that has been created here within our four walls. And, I just want to say thank you for the opportunity to speak today. Fred was kind enough to give us the opportunity to, talk about the efficacy of indexation and, some of the nuanced, methodologies and rules that go into, creating an index that will become the preeminent benchmark, like we did with the S-Network Composite Closed-End Fund Index. It is universally regarded as the benchmark for the closed-end fund industry, and all closed-end funds, or most, are benchmarked to it. With that said, we did aim to create an index that would target yield, and typically an index development process starts with a given thesis, right? And so that thesis was, the investment thesis was somewhat realized through the use of closed-end funds. And, closed-end funds are, have their nuances, and I'm certainly no expert at, with closed-end funds in and of themselves. But in terms of designing a strategy that creates a diversified portfolio of, closed-end funds that will ultimately limit the exposure to any one given closed-end fund to, 8% of a cap, and, the index is right in line with the RIC and compliance codes, UCITS compliance codes with respect to, allocation and diversification across the board for funds. With that said, the index that we did create has a trailing 12-month yield of roughly 8%. The index has been licensed to Invesco Power Shares for the purpose of an ETF back, I believe, in sometime 2010 or 2009. It has a terrific, terrific track record, yielding close to 8% each year since inception. With that said, I'll kind of stop. I'll let you guys read the report, and then I'll can jump back on at a later date to kind of walk through the process after everyone's had an opportunity to review it.
Patrick, thank you. And for those on the call, realize Patrick and I decided to do this 5 minutes before the dial-in. So I really congratulate him on having anything to say at all in that short amount of time. Does anyone have any questions for Patrick in advance of reading the report, or shall we just go on with the conference call? Questions for Patrick? Not surprising, Patrick. These guys are pretty thorough. They like to read the report. So let's move on to the bond market.
Hey, Fred,
yeah, Jeff?
Hey, Fred, it's Jeff. I actually got a question,
please,
for him. So, Patrick, with the creation of ETFs and more people going to passive investing, which clearly is a function of, basically creating an index, do you have any thoughts on what that means for the market compared to where we were, say, 10 years ago, compared to where we were, where we are right now, and compared to where we're going to be 10 years out from now?
Yeah, I don't necessarily have a, kind of crystal ball to look to the future to see what will happen. What I will say and what I do think is happening and what has happened, especially since, 10 years ago we were kind of right at the, end of the, financial crisis and the beginning of the bull market, right? Obviously, we have seen a tremendous shift of assets from traditional active managed mutual funds into passively managed index funds, be it mutual funds or the ever-growing ETF space, right, in and of itself. Like Fred said before, I think there will be shifts to models in and of themselves, and the models could still be based off of indexes for that matter, right? And there could potentially be a advocation and adaption of what we kind of see here as maybe a shift, which is the introduction of direct indexing, right? So you could expect to see, I think, some use of direct index models on different platforms. I do think that there will continue to be a shift in assets from passive, or excuse me, from active to passive. But the guys that kind of taught me, what they always told me was, you know, when you see one pendulum swing so far one way, it's ultimately probably going to swing back another way, right? And so when everything is ultimately benchmarked and the methodologies are all rules-based and transparent, I do think that there will be an opportunity for, you know, active managers to potentially beat those benchmarks again, right? Because, you know, that information is out there. It's in the open. It's, you know, available on websites. And when everyone puts their rules out, right, you know, there always will be, you know, a smart guy or a smart woman who says, oh, man, I think I can, I think I can beat this. Hopefully that makes
sense.
Yeah,
so like one additional, and I'll let Fred jump back and go on to bonds here. Did you see BlackRock's announcement 2 days ago? Basically, they're redoing their entire management structure, and the goal now is to create globally what they've done in the U.S. So therefore, the question for you is, if what has happened in the U.S. then also happens globally, what are your thoughts on that? If basically the entire globe becomes passively driven from being actively driven, do you think that's a great thing, or do you think that's not a great thing? What's your thought process on that? Because clearly that's the mandate that BlackRock is going to go with here, is to try and, you know, passivize the rest of the world now.
Yeah, I think there's a recognition of, you know, managers and fund sponsor companies and, you know, the management of those companies that there is a ongoing fee compression. And, you know, investors want, you know, exposure to, you know, passively managed products that have to have an index behind it. So, yeah, I'm excited as an index provider. With respect to, you know, all those in the industry, just like kind of how I referred to before, you know, the gentleman that I've worked for that taught me everything that I know, they've always told me, you know, once you see the pendulum swing so far one way, it will ultimately come back, right? So when you look at the, you know, ongoing, you know, expansion of passively managed strategies from the U.S. to international developed markets, be it in Europe or in the Pacific Rim, right, you will see, you know, individuals, hedge funds that will ultimately start beating the benchmarks again because all those rules and all that money is now in passively managed strategies, right? So I think that there is always going to be a give and a take. I do think that there will be an opportunity for active managers to, you know, beat the market. But, you know, I also think that, you know, as the market expands, particularly the ETF market and passively managed product market, right, that there it's in the best interest of the end investor, right, rather than, you know, Joe waking up one day or Jane waking up one day and having an idea and saying, oh, I think I have too much exposure, I'm out. Everything that is predicated on a passively managed strategy has a rules-based deterministic methodology that dictates when things are changed and why things are changed, rather than just an individual waking up saying, it's time to change.
That's an interesting answer, Patrick. And I want to throw one thing out about this that I read. I literally just read, and I've got to reread it because it was fairly complicated. Patrick, there's a study out of the University of North Carolina that apparently looked at mutual funds and when they bought their first positions in a stock to see if, in fact, the managers were better stock pickers than the public. And the thesis of the article seems to be that the managers, the active managers, are better stock pickers, but because of investors putting money in the fund and taking money out of the fund, the managers are buying and selling stocks when they have to and not when they want to. And that's why they're underperforming. And again, I got to read that, but it was in MarketWatch this morning, quoted as an article from the University of North Carolina, and I think that's somewhat disingenuous, but it was still very interesting to read as something in favor of active management. And yeah, they of course didn't come up with any sort of solution or way around that, but it was interesting. With that, any more questions for Patrick, or we'll go on with the call as we normally would. And Patrick, thank you for the article. Thank you for coming on today, and thank you for agreeing to come on in the future if we have some questions for you.
Yes, certainly, and thank you for the opportunity. Sorry if I was brief. We did just speak about a couple minutes before this call, so you know, typically I am more well prepared, but hopefully I was able to kind of shed a little bit of light on the indexing process. You know, I didn't get into the detail. There's tons of rules that you can go into, and you know, all the data, the derived data, and you know, that goes into it. You know, and I'd be happy to share some thoughts on all that on another call.
Fantastic.
So
thank you very much for coming on.
Patrick and Fred, may I ask you one question?
Sure, you can.
I joined a little bit late. Where can I find the report that Patrick was talking about?
It is coming out in the monthly Yogesh, which should be out right after the call. And, yeah, I'm sorry, Yogesh, I had to go to a funeral, so everything's about a day late being published. My fault.
No problem. But, Patrick, I look forward to reading your article and then come back to you if I question. I'd bother Fred rather than you.
Okay, yeah, bother
Thank
me,
you,
and
buddy.
We'll get Patrick if it's something I can't answer, which is likely on the subject of indexing. So, fantastic. Any other questions for Patrick or remarks before we move on to bonds? Very good. Okay. Let's look at TLT for a minute, and let's look at it long term. This is one of the longer duration, you know, 20-year bond ETFs that we follow. We follow it because it is the most actively traded. And what we mentioned in last week's weekly is probably going to turn out to be the operative thing here, which is we have been on a monthly buy signal on TLT for the last few months, and that signal is actually now becoming overbought. It's not yet into overbought territory on the monthly stochastic, but it's close, and on the weekly stochastic, of course, it did get into that area. So we're expecting on this rollover back down into the 112 area on treasuries, on TLT. Now, what's interesting here is, you know, in light of the Powell announcement, this may just turn into a giant trading range, but if so, we still think we're close to the top of it. So we are still recommending our alternatives for yield, things like PCEF, things like preferreds, that sort of thing, which are giving us much better yields. And we think, again, that because the rate situation, according to the Fed, is stabilized, that these will be even safer investments and give you a lot better yield. So no big change for us on bonds. We note that LQD, the corporate bond ETF, has bounced up against 120. It's in the same sort of position. Everything looks about the same. I'm going to run through to commodities real quick and currencies just because we're running a little late here. In the commodities, DBC, of course, has got some oil weighting to it. It's up in the 16 area. 16 to 1650 is, you know, short-term resistance. We don't see a big drop in oil, but we do see that possibly pulling back to 1575. We do note that DBB, our metals, basic metals ETF, is rallying back and trading pretty well. It's up at short-term resistance through here, should put it back to 19 or 20. We will write about that this week, because we have not written about that in a while. The big news here is gold that hit our target of 126 on GLD has pulled down. The daily stochastic is down in oversold territory, and the weekly is almost turning up, as we mentioned in the weekly. So there's probably an opportunity here for a tactical trade in GLD from 121 back up to 126. And, of course, the big news here for us in terms of the currency market is the dollar is still strong It bounced right up to 2610 a couple of days ago. That's the main resistance. It's sold off from that, but not by much. Through 2610 and 97.50 on the dollar index would be a real shot in the dollar. And if we get that, note that the euro could probably get down to our longstanding target on FXE of 104 to 105. I've mentioned on the call before that Amy and I and her son, Jody, are thinking of going to Europe. That is approximately when I'm going to do the big buy on euro-denominated traveler's checks. The dollar, and we wrote about this in the weekly, we've got to see how that looks with PXH and some of the emerging markets indexes. For now, we remain in India. We're using INDY. That's been a big outperformer. If Yogesh has any comments on India as a fundamental investor, he is without peer in India. We'll take those, but from a technical standpoint, that's where we are right now. Still nervous about Europe. We see an oversold bounce on DB, Deutsche Bank. But in that, unless this can get back above 930, it's still a downtrend. And we did have the lowest weekly close except for December last week. So we still have the operative fears that we've had in Europe. If you have to be in Europe, EWL is still our favorite. With that, let me pass the call over to Jeff Garbaz for some of his typical questions, and then we'll move on to questions from the field. Jeff, do you have anything for us?
Yeah. So Fred, I'm going to start with a hypothetical and put you on the spot. What's your target high potentially for the S&P for this year?
Is 302.
That was what we put so in our forecast the equivalent
for the year.
Of,
so 3020
to
3100.
Of 3020.
Yeah.
And so what's interesting is yesterday, J.P. Morgan's quant guy, who a lot of people respect, I think I give him a 6.5 out of 10, but he's kind of right where you are, which is, you know, saying 300 on SPY. So he's kind of close as well. So that begs the question, why would we be putting money in here when we've only got a couple more percent up for the rest of the year? To me, the much better play seems to be raise a lot of cash right now, wait for the inevitable pullback that's going to come or not come, and I'm not missing anything. And if we trade down again, down to like, say, 260 on SPY or 250 or 240, then I've got another amazing opportunity to get long. And if we're only going to go, and I'm going to basically way, way outperform for this year, but like it seems to me like that's kind of more of the trade. Why? What's wrong with that logic?
Jeff, what's wrong with it is something that you don't deal with in hedge fund world, but that a lot of our clients have to deal with, which is they're not allowed to hold huge amounts of cash. They get variances and get penalized for doing it. They're forced to invest it in their models. So what we're recommending is actually holding, you know, towards the upper end of cash that people normally hold with the idea that we invest that. But, you know, you have to be, in most of our clients' business, invested in their models, or they get in trouble for it. And, you know, Jeff, there's always a possibility that we're wrong. Again, we think the big surprise for this year is that the economy is actually stronger than anyone expects in the United States after this European growth fear stuff goes away, that the market does better and that interest rates are higher because of all that. So, you know, until we get a technical sign that the market is really going to have a significant correction, we have to stay with it.
Okay, so along those lines, I get that 1,000%. And actually, this is kind of interesting. You wouldn't know this because it's only on Bloomberg, but the city does this whole series of economic surprises, and they do it on the U.S., they do it on Europe, they do it on a ton of countries as well. So what's so interesting about that right now is if you look at the city economic surprise index number on China as an example, it really peaked back in March of 2018, and it's been trying to bottom, and now it's actually gone from a minus 40 to positive. and Europe looks like it's actually turning up, whereas the U.S. is still kind of moving lower and still kind of struggling. Is there a chance that like Europe and China lead and they start to get better, then all of a sudden everyone in the U.S. says, "Holy cow, we're not going to slow in the second half and we're going to be off to the races." Is that a natural way things could go? And do the
Yeah.
charts of like FXI and EFA kind of show that right now?
Again, GXC, which is a better ETF in terms of performance, but also a blue chip ETF than FXI, certainly is trading up to resistance, but it could go through. We mentioned in the weekly EWS Singapore, we have a breakout on that above 2460 or so, and of course, the damn thing's at 2458, right? Making me, which means we gave it a good number, but it's very frustrating. Jeff, I may be too worried about Europe here. The reason I'm so worried is when I see one of the things I learned at Merrill Lynch from my friend Sheryl Rowan and also from Rich Bernstein is that when the financial sector isn't healthy, you've got real risk. And when I look at Deutsche Bank, when I look at EUFN, it's not real healthy here. But EUFN may have bottomed and may get better. We'll have to see if it can put on a move above 2070, which isn't that far away on EUFN. If that were to happen, that would probably bring that scenario into play. Part of our function, Jeff, at the Fed Report here is to sort of function as an early warning system for fundamentalists. And to that light, we have seen, since we started talking about it in the middle of last year, a lot more concern about the European financial system on the part of normal fundamental writers. It may be that those fears are overblown, and if they are, the U.S. market could do very, very well, and that's another reason not to just say we're at the top of a trading range. Sell it. Remember, Jeff, and again, you've never, I don't think, been an FA, but one of the hardest things for an FA, one of our clients, to do is sell something and then buy it back higher. Clients always ask the guy, "Why did you do that?" Right? Sometimes there's no really good explanation for that. Now, one of the ways advisors get around that is they sell something and they buy a like something if they're wrong. But it creates a lot of questions, and most people, our clients that I've talked to have not had a lot of euphoria. I want to send you double the money I have and invest it all in high-flying stocks or anything like that. Even though the bearish sentiment has creeped back up, it still doesn't feel like we're making a major top like we did when we were seeing that last January, for example. And any comments on that from the field in the second part of the call, absolutely, we'd appreciate. But Jeff, did I answer your question?
So my last question for you is, so GLD, if you're wrong about it, today it got down to a little bit below 121, and now it's just going ballistic. I mean, it's up like basically 60 cents at 21.64, and it closed yesterday at 21.85. And I don't know what news just hit, but something clearly hit that's causing it to really jump here. If it breaks the 121 level, then you think there's more downside ahead? And if it holds, does it, mean that we could go back up towards the 126 number again?
Yeah, I think if it holds this 121, which we had actually talked about again in the weekly, that it could go back to 126. And a note, again, for people on the call, especially for newer subscribers, part of the reason we put out price targets is that we think they're going to be hit. What that means to us when they're hit is not, "Oh my God, we dumped this thing," but it does mean that the risk in it suddenly becomes higher of making a major top. Sort of like last year with the spider, our range for the spider last year in December of last year, we published, or the year before, actually, January of last year, we published a range of 294 to 302, and the high for the year was 293.75 or some damn thing. And certainly the risk was higher after it came close and hit that number. So, yeah, we're happy adding gold. If you've got gold in your models and you don't have a position, you're down towards the bottom end of a trading range now. It's a good time today to add it. I wish Jeff had mentioned that 10, 15 minutes ago so I could have told you to add it on the absolute low, but, you know, what the heck. But, yeah, Jeff, I think you're right. There is a tactical opportunity here.
Okay, I'm done.
Very good. Any questions from the field on anything? Let's have questions. Star 6 to unmute.
Fred, it's Joseph.
Joseph, how are you? I've been thinking about you.
I'm well, thanks. Apropos your indexing conversation earlier, could you take a look at a few ETFs for me?
Sure.
PBE, Papa Bravo Echo.
Yeah.
Right.
That should do real well, and it's a nice head and shoulders bottom. Joseph, I could buy that right away. I think biotechs in general are perking up here. Sorry, what's your next one?
The next one is X-Ray Bravo India, XBI.
Yeah, that's the one that we have been recommending simply because PBE is not on everyone's platform. But that also looks good as long as it stays above 84, which I think it's going to do.
And the last one is Frank Bravo Tango, FBT.
FBT. That's also very strong. That's a little stronger than XBI if you want to buy that. That needs to hold roughly 145, say, or it'll start to turn negative. But it looks pretty decent.
All right. And of those three, anyone stand out as being a better bet at this point?
You know, the riskier bet is FBT simply because it's closer to its benchmark. XBI is probably the more sane bet. The main thing is IBB, which is the most common, looks by far worse than any of the three you mentioned. I wouldn't use that IBB at all. Joseph, for you, probably XBI because you're not a total maniac trader on the upside. But both of those, the FBT and the First Trust one and XBI, both look good.
Right, thanks.
Got it. Other questions?
Hey, Fred, this is Brandon in Green Bay. Can you take a look at Pfizer for me, please, PFE?
Yeah, I've been, you know, basically looking at that as being in a fairly long base, you know, really consolidation since the highs in August of last year. Above 43.50, it should go make new highs right away. I like the way the stock is trading, but, Brandon, someone has pointed out to me that I am essentially overweight the sector that's going to have the most news, pro and con, before the election, and I should probably think about changing that on any weakness in XLV. But for now, I still like XLV, and I still like these drug stocks. I, of course, picked Pfizer. LLY did a little bit better, but Pfizer is still tradable to me.
Got it. Thank you.
Sure. Other questions?
Hi, Scott.
Scott, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Got a little static. Take a look at CAT, please.
Yeah, I was just asked about this. Apparently, Merrill has come out with a new recommendation on this, Scott.
Read the report.
Sorry?
Just read the report, and he's
just
an amazing analyst.
Yeah. No, he is really good, and I like the looks of the stock. On the weekly chart, the stochastic is in buy mode and just above mid-range. Above 144 would target 155 to 160. I don't have any problem adding this stock right now.
Okay, great. And what was my other question? I loved your bid on Singapore. Would you buy that here?
You know, Okay. Yes, I would. The only thing I would say is leave some money out. If this doesn't really get through this whole 2460 area, and of course, Scott, as we're sitting here, 2462, right? If it doesn't really get through here, back below 24 and add to it is fine. But this has got a great yield, and it's a great chart that could hit 2829.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
And then, if you don't mind, I would just throw my 2 cents in on the conversation before.
Sure.
Just my personal I think that people are – retail investors are just not positioned in this market, and looking at those fund flows, everything's been going into bonds. Yet, you know, you've got China stimulating, you've got the China deal possibly announced this afternoon, and you've had the March was the first month where you've had earnings revision ratio uptick. And, you know, now with Mueller done, I think, you know, chances of a China deal are that much more, you know, likely. And I just don't think investors are positioned for it, so I'm staying very long. Thanks.
Yeah, I agree. Scott, I should mention, one of my concerns is that the market actually sells off on a China deal, since everybody's been talking about that being the catalyst for a big advance. I think that sell-off would be a buying opportunity. And the other interesting thing, and I don't want to put words in her mouth, but I did spend part of the day yesterday and dinner with Cheryl Rowan, and she's worried that overall the earnings comparisons aren't going to be as good as people think they are. And that's her 2 cents. I'm not an earnings guy. I've never been able to figure out earnings. I just know it's better to have them than not have them, and that's partially a joke back to my 2000 self when Jack Grubman told me that his companies were all great because they had no earnings, and because they had no earnings, they couldn't disappoint investors.
The hair stands up.
Yeah.
Hair on the back of my neck stands up when I hear that guy's name.
You know, Scott, he actually said that to me, and in a very angry voice. So, and that's when I said to myself, you know, this guy's off the rails, and I downgraded WorldCom at Robinson Humphrey at 39 in large part because of that conversation. And, of course, the problems with WorldCom had nothing to do with that, but he was a bit of a jerk. Anyway, more questions.
Right.
Any questions for me?
Fred?
Yeah? Hey, Nancy.
Hi, it's Nancy in Cleveland. Can you compare two ETFs? These are not for new purchases. These are for perhaps sales. FEZ is the first one, and the second one is DIM.
DIM. Let me have a look at this.
D as in dog.
Dog,
yeah.
Idiot, Mary. And, of course,
Mary,
now
you got
my
it.
Computer freezes, so let's try this again. FEZ, it's right up in resistance. Dog, idiot, Mary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, honestly, and this is probably a cop-out, the charts are very, very similar, and they're both up at resistance.
Mm-hmm.
I would keep the one that has the higher yield, and that's probably DIM.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're really, you know, this is one of those ones where you flip a coin and there's really no way for me to tell exactly on this. I mean, I could come up with all sorts of...
What's your... So if the stocks for some reason decide to break out of resistance, just, you know, for whatever reason, where would you say very short-term targets?
On FEZ, to the top end of the range that we're hitting the bottom end of at 39, and on DIM,
mm-hmm.
66 or so.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Sure. Other questions?
Hey, Fred, your thoughts on Boeing and CVS, please?
Sure. I think that Boeing, you know, we talked about that being safe but maybe not doing much on the upside, and it's acting a little better than we thought. I think the low is in on that, but it wouldn't surprise me to see this be a 398 to 400 on the top side and 360 or so on the downside consolidation pattern for a bit. But I mean, I want to be, if you want Boeing, you want to be in it here. It's had a nice dip. And again, another way of answering that question is, do I see Boeing going to 325 or 300 from here? No, I do not. That would be a big surprise technically.
Great, thanks. What about CBS?
CBS, Charlie Victor Sam or Charlie Boy Sam?
Charlie Victor Sam.
I hate that stock. It's trading so badly compared to Walgreens that I think the risk here is you buy this and it goes slowly up to 55 or 56 and doesn't do much. That they've had every opportunity to rally here, and it just won't do it. And I don't know why. I've read some reports on the stock that say it should be doing very well, and it's not. So that's my concern. I would just avoid that name.
Great, thanks.
Good enough. Yeah, I think Walgreens is WBI. That got creamed, unfortunately, since I last looked at it. So probably the drugstores are not where to be. Let me look at RAD. I've always looked at like RAD. And again, all of these are going down. Whatever it is, this is not the group to be in. All of these drug stocks sort of look sort of icky to me. This is not totally RAD. Other questions?
Hey, Fred, it's Jeff. I want to jump in on Boeing for a second again.
Sure.
Okay. So the daily stochastic has gotten back above 80, so that's good. But I don't understand the logic of, like, why you don't think that, like, 325 is doable. Because when I look at the weekly stochastic, it's mid-range right now coming down. It hasn't been down, you know, to recycle in a long time. And if it gets down where it does recycle on the weekly, then that's probably going to put it at least somewhere probably between 350 and 325. And a bigger problem to me is the monthly stochastic. You know, it turned above 80 in 2016. This is a good lesson for everyone. It stayed there all of 17. For 18 until we hit the fourth quarter stuff, it got back above, and now it's back below. I mean, the best pattern you could absolutely ever have on a stock is for that monthly stochastic to stay above 80 for extended periods of time. That's where you make an incredible amount of money. But that's now broken on Boeing. And the whole reason that the stock ran from December into its peak, you know, which is over 100 points, there's this idea that they're a duopoly, and they're not handling this crisis well at all. So why don't – I mean, to me, it's like this could be an incredibly risky stock to hold right now, and the weekly and the monthly kind of validate it. Like, so
Jeff, I'll tell you a little trick that I've used to fair effect. And that is stocks that are really bad downtrends that are going to make lower lows, the daily stochastic does not get above 80 on the first advance before it goes back down below 20. Generally, when you go above 80 in one of these on the daily, the stock has made a bottom that's going to hold for at least a while. Let's take a quick look, you know, again. Yeah, I agree with you on the monthly, but the argument for the S&P is on the monthly too, by the way. That's the argument for a fairly substantial correction in the next 6 months. And that's why, again, we're saying we should
except
hold
the, except the S&P now has gotten back above 80, though.
On the daily, yeah.
On the monthly.
On the monthly. You know, if it rolls over here, it's a whole brand-new sell signal. And if you look at IJR and IWM, those are very positioned to recycle.
Yep.
Right?
So I think that's a really great point. I never had thought of it that way. If you get below it and you rip all the way to 80, then that's probably a very good tell that you're not going to revisit that, at least for the near term.
That's exactly right. And, and Jeff, that really does work quite well, even, you know, on downtrending things. You know, that generally signifies the stop of the downtrend for at least a while.
Well, that hit may be worth the price of admission for the next 10 years for everyone.
Well,
that's
a
really great point.
Just yeah, please. And, you know, Jeff, if I could get all the little dorky rules I have for myself on paper, that would be real interesting. And for everyone on the call, where I came up with that was buying five-minute charts of the S&P when I was day trading, when the hourly chart hadn't turned up and you've had a downtrend going for a while. You know, a perfect example of that, if anyone really wants to look at this, is to look at the five-minute chart of IWM when you had a couple of rallies that didn't make it above 80, and then finally one that did between 2 and 3 o'clock yesterday. Those all said lower lows, and we made them, and then you finally got above 80. The pullback was a higher low and a nice shot to the upside. So, you know, take that for what it's worth. It works on very short-term charts, and it does work on daily charts too. And I know that most of our client base have no interest in looking at five-minute charts, but that's how you come up with these rules. Other questions? Very well. Going once. Going twice.
Fred, good morning. It's Paul.
Paul, how are you?
Great, sir. Hey, great call. It seems like everybody on the call has touched on the hot topics. If I can kind of summarize and then ask your opinion how it might be resolved. You know, obviously, your comments about the current Desmond, I forget the gentleman's name, but about the retail and institutional investor generally underinvested in this environment with
God
the retail
said that, and he always
and
makes
institutional.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Jeff's comment about how far we are from your year-end targets, although he said 2%. Jeff, I apologize. I think it's 5.25, which I think makes a difference between 302 and 287. It does appear as though capital is behind and certainly somewhat confused. I would venture a guess those with extra cash come in each morning and think about buying, and then the next morning they think about selling, and so there's a lot of confusion. What would give you, in your technical analysis, some sort of clarification as to resolution to the Desmonds? So, for example, you've got two of them up and two of them down, the SOX and the S&P Technology Index, which have been the leaders, just touched their highs from last year yesterday. You know, that's been one of the strong ones. When you see these things resolve, do you see one Desmond start to turn and then it's 3-1 and that's an indication it's going in that direction?
That's it, Paul. We'll see something go positive here. You know, either the transports or small cap will go positive here, or the S&P and the NASDAQ, one of them will go negative, and that will be the change. There is one interesting thing, though, that people aren't really talking about in the technical world, and I'm tempted to call my friend Tom McClellan and ask him about it, because it is interesting. Generally, when you have huge surges in breadth like we had, small cap leads, IWM especially leads. It's 2,000 stocks, right? Not 500 or 100 or whatever. Yet this time that did not happen. You see what I'm saying? All that money went into fewer stocks. And, you know, from the standpoint of being a technician, the thing we worry about the most is a narrow market. And but at the same time, the fact that the NASDAQ composite is actually on the plus side in my model, and for everyone who's not sure about about the long-term trend model, it consists of four indexes, the S&P 500, the entire NASDAQ composite, small cap as measured by IJR, and the transports, with those last two being the economically sensitive ones. You know, it is interesting that the NASDAQ composite is not one of the negative ones, and that's where stocks go to die, right? We all know that the NASDAQ composite is where you go just before you get permanently delisted. So the fact that that is positive is a plus that sort of makes the breadth look better. The Russell makes the breadth look worse. It's very I'm not supposed to be confused, right? I'm supposed to know all the answers here. That's why everyone's on my call and I'm not on everyone else's. But this is very, very difficult here. And no, it really is, because you're seeing a lot
That's why I asked the question, Fred.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we'll know in the fullness of time, but if we're invested in our models and holding a little bit of extra cash, it's generally easier for most of our clients to add cash than take it away and then add it back again next month. You see what I'm saying? And I'm worried that we'll do exactly what you're saying, which is, oh, my God, we have to buy. Oh, no, we have to sell. Oh, phooey, we have to buy. Oh, no, we have to sell. And get involved in one of those going back and forth every month, which generally doesn't help most of our clients. I know, Paul, you've got a lot more freedom in that regard.
Looking at the shorter term on the Desmonds, IYT looks like it's trying to do the turn versus XTN is not. Which one do you rely on more?
Yeah, and that's the broader index. So, again, that's a concern. I like to see XTN doing better than everything, and it's not, and that's a concern. And really, the Desmond comes from my long-term system, Paul. I just love that. But one day I think I'm going to be hearing a rocket launch, and they're going to come out with, you know, 5-4-3 Desmond. But I don't use it on the short-term stuff. It's really just the longer-term stuff as a gauge of our overall market health. It's been pretty effective.
Okay. And then one comment about the other one. So I think either you're going to have the transports confirm and go up and then maybe drag the Russell, or you'll see the NASDAQ top out, because that's the one that's touched its high. If you're looking for signs of the NASDAQ to top out, I look at the flyers, and in particular, you're looking at Workday, Zen, Cadence, Rapid, Ring, Palo Alto. If you'll notice today, they're all down between 3%, 4%, and 5%. That is the behind-the-scenes weakness in that. But the market is broadening by moving into the industrials and the financials and discretionary. So, to your point earlier, could we consolidate a little bit here, build this base? Pop tier 302, then make a decision. It seems likely.
Yeah. And remember, the symbol that I'm using for the NASDAQ is the old symbol, IXIC or COMPQX, the NASDAQ composite, which is not doing as well as the Qs. It's doing well, but it's not doing as well as the Qs.
And it hasn't been in the up markets for quite a while because it just doesn't have the concentration, right?
Yeah, but as long as it's got a positive trend system, and it does, it has to be graded positive in my model. And that's why I pick it. That's the one that should go negative first if things really suck.
But Fred, you cannot deny the fact that if you look at October 4th, 2018, as an important day in the turn in the markets, the NASDAQ composite is at that day. It is at the moving average where it broke. So it's right there.
Yeah.
It has started to test that resistance. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with China as the pop to get to 302 or not. Yeah.
Yeah, and, okay. You know.
And then one last one. Fred.
Sure. Go,
I'm sorry.
Paul, go.
I didn't mean to interrupt. NYA, the downtrend line, 12950 to 12975 from the top. Does that hold any credence in your book, being the broadest index, which may be a compilation of all of those combined a little bit?
It's more that we get through 13,000 on that, but again, it's not part of the model, but again, it does look interesting, and so far it definitely is lower highs and lower lows. that August, September, October high was lower, and the low in December was lower than the low in January. So it's lower highs.
Absolutely.
And lower
you're
lows.
Talking a year and a quarter, and it hasn't touched
yeah.
it. And it's still pretty decent. So the breadth is not as spectacular.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a tough one, and again, no need to jump up and down and sell everything, but it's a very tough one, and if we get a dip, that 20% cash that people are holding, will probably come in quite handy.
Much appreciated, Fred.
Got it. Any other questions? Going once? Going twice? Very well. Thanks to Patrick if he's still on, and we'll see everyone next week. This will end the Fred Report technical market call for April 4th, and that monthly should be coming out so you can read the article and that we discussed. Have a good weekend.